Call the committee meeting to order. It is now 1:15. Committee members present are Representative Anderson, Representative O'Connell, Representative Phillips, and myself. We are going to be taking testimony today on the bills that we had an overview on Monday, HJR 22, 473, 573, 575, 576, and 577. My intention to take persons in the order that they sign up. Robin, if you give me that first sign-up sheet, we will start with that. First person that we will hear today is Karen Robinson. Mrs. Robinson, if you would take the chair at the end of the table.
Can I be later? She has some information she was going to give me real quick.
Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Jackie Aruman?
No, I'm just here.
Okay. Barry Stern. Barry, if you would please state for the record your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Barry Jeffrey Stern. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm speaking today for the Department of Law. I'd like to address my comments to, I think, six bills. 576, 473, 577, 578, 573, and 575. I think I'll start with the ones that I don't think we'll have any disagreement over. House Bill 577 is the bill that prohibits a person from resisting an unlawful arrest. That's not a violent unlawful arrest. We strongly support this legislation. In fact, we have submitted identical legislation previously in Senate Bill 535 and House Bill 553. We think that the action of the legislature in adopting that provision back when the criminal code was adopted was one of the most regrettable provisions that was adopted, and we're happy that the committee is giving attention to repealing that right to resist an arrest. House Bill 573 raises the penalty from an A misdemeanor to a C felony for the crime of tampering with a witness. We strongly support that provision also. That is also identical to a provision we have in legislation the governor has submitted in Senate Bill 535 and an identical legislation that was introduced in the House last year by the Judiciary Committee, House Bill 553. House Bill 575 is the statute on assaults. And what that provision does is change the culpable mental state for a number of ways of committing assault from intentionally to recklessly. And as your counsel very correctly pointed out, the problem with the current law is in requiring that a person act intentionally to commit an assault. Intoxication can be raised as a defense to the crime. When the criminal code was being adopted, there was some, it wasn't really clear whether assaults with weapons were general intent or specific intent crimes. And the reason that's important is that if it's a specific intent crime, intoxication is relevant. If it's a general intent crime, it is not. The criminal code adopted the position as a specific intent crime, but shortly after that was decided in the Criminal Code Commission, the Supreme Court held it was a general intent crime, and we feel that putting recklessly back is very important to eliminate the defense of intoxication for these forms of assault. And again, this is identical to a provision we have submitted. There is only one thing that I would request the committee to do. I think Section 5 in the bill is unnecessary, and I think that if it was passed, we would have some substantial difficulties with the defense of intoxication and other statutes. Section 5 emphasizes that intoxication is not a defense to the crime of assault in the second degree. The problem with that is that the crime has now been changed to recklessly, as I understand it, and the definition of recklessly already says that. And by putting it specifically in this provision, statutes where it isn't specifically put, you could be raised the issue that it is a defense. So I would suggest they'd be eliminated. But other than that, we strongly support that legislation, too. The bail pending appeal statute, House Bill 578.
Excuse me,
yes.
Mr. Stern. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Freeman has now joined the committee. You may continue.
Yes, thank you. House Bill 578 is the statute on bail pending appeal. And what the recommendation does is eliminate bail pending appeal for certain crimes. We support the concept of limiting the right to bail pending appeal, and we have introduced legislation that would limit it to Class A felonies and unclassified felonies. This bill, of course, is different. It's broader. It includes some offenses that are not Class A felonies, certainly. Assault in the third degree is a Class C felony. Assault in the third degree can cover, for example, the act of pointing a weapon at someone and placing that person in fear of injury, regardless of whether the gun is loaded. It's a very broad statute. And I'd just like to raise for your consideration whether you need to make this statute so broad. In other words, to limit bail pending appeal simply to unclassified and Class A felonies, we would submit would get at the real problem, and that is the violent offenses. And not all these offenses are definitely crimes against the person, but another example would be criminally negligent homicide. That's a Class C felony under paragraph 4, and that covers the act where the person does not intend to cause death but acts in a grossly negligent manner. And it's questionable whether bail pending appeal should be limited for that crime. We're not necessarily saying we're opposing this bill. We just want to point out we have a difference of opinion where the line should be drawn. Again, we do it for A felonies and unclassified felonies. I should also say that, as Mr. Cook correctly pointed out, our current statute has been attacked in federal district court, and the court has said that it, I believe, violates equal protection because not all violent crimes are covered in the statute. The one disadvantage of picking and choosing crimes is that it could be argued that some crime that is similar to the crimes you have listed is not included, and therefore the statute violates equal protection. We try to get away from that by saying all A felonies and all unclassified felonies, and the code says those are the most serious offenses. So in terms of making the statute less subject to constitutional attack, ours would probably be a better one, but in terms of being more inclusive, yours certainly is. The videotaping bill, House Bill 576, we strongly support this legislation, and would offer the following comments so for your consideration. We think that in terms of the age of the victim, the critical point should be the age at the time of the assault, and not the age at the time the person is testifying. So, in other words, if you have an assault on someone who's 15, that's obviously covered. But if you have an assault on a person, the age at the time of the testimony should not matter. It should simply be the age at the time of the assault. I should also point out, probably for your staff's consideration, that the presumption in 1245.047 about that the child is likely to suffer emotional distress, that seems to me to be tied into excluding the public as opposed to the videotaping, and you might consider whether that presumption is proper. And I'm directing specifically to page 1 of the bill, lines 21 through 28, and it says there is a presumption that a child who is under the age of 16 at the time of the alleged assault will suffer severe emotional distress if required to testify in open court, which may be overcome by the presentation of evidence to the contrary at the time the application for an order excluding the public is considered. That's not what we're talking about here in this statute. We're talking about a videotaping. This is identical language that appears in the next statute, which is excluding the public. So I think somewhere something went wrong in drafting this. And I should also point out, when I initially considered this bill, I asked myself whether it was necessary to have both provisions. In other words, an order excluding the public as well as allowing for videotaping. In other words, if you have the authorization for videotaping, why would you ever need to exclude the public? And I discussed this with Vic Crum, who is our Assistant Attorney General, who's heading up our efforts to vigorously prosecute sexual assaults. He's stationed in Juneau and has particular expertise in this area. And it's his feeling that in certain cases, it may be more impressive to have the victim actually testify before the jury in a closed courtroom as opposed to placing the victim on videotape. So the two provisions actually complement each other. In terms of the constitutionality, I'm sorry.
Have they had any experience in the state where you have the victim in front of the jury and the victim just doing a single videotape? I mean, I want to, you know, you're making a statement, mm-hmm. but I don't know whether that's true or not, unless somebody's had some experience with it. And I'd like to find out if they have.
I have not researched what the experience in other states have been under these statutes. I don't know whether counsel to the committee has. All I can tell you is that from a person, Vic Crum, who really has concentrated on prosecuting sexual assault cases, particularly ones involving young victims, mm-hmm. it was his professional judgment that in certain cases he would want to have the victim before the jury as opposed to being on videotape. In other cases, he'd like to have the victim on videotape. That's his...
Would the victim have any say?
Certainly. I mean, certainly. If the victim didn't express a reluctance to testify in a closed court, that would certainly be considered. If the victim said, you know, if the parents of the victim and the victim both felt, no, we want to do it on videotape, that would certainly be one of the most important considerations in deciding how to proceed.
Okay, so then I just want to get that clear.
Yeah, we would be looking at it in terms of how best are we going to present the victim to the finder of fact. And in some cases, it may be closing the courtroom, others may be videotaping. I think the committee recognizes that both these provisions will be subject to constitutional attack. I think that the Storrs opinion was cited at the last meeting, which seemed to limit the right to use videotaping. But that, I think, is distinguishable. I think when we're talking about a young victim of a sexual assault, we're going to have a pretty strong argument to the court that it should be allowed, and pretty confident, at least as to videotaping, that we would be successful there.
Yes. For the record, I would like to know if the victim is booked or banned. You may continue.
Thank you. The last bill I'd like to testify, where I have the most comments on, is House Bill 473. And this bill provides for mandatory minimum sentences for the crime of sexual assault in the first degree, which is made different than the crime of sexual assault in the first degree under the current law. And it also provides increased penalties for more than one unclassified crime committed in the same criminal act, like a kidnapping and a murder committed together. And I think both the committee and the Department of Law agree that when you're dealing with first offenders, and this is really all the bill attempts to deal with, I think the prime emphasis on the bill is when you're dealing with first offenders, there is a need to revise the penalty provisions we have in current law. But where we differ from the committee is that we feel it should not only apply to sexual assault, but it should apply to all Class A felonies. And the Class A felonies are the most serious offenses in the criminal code other than murder and kidnapping, and would include such things as assault in the first degree, which in some instances are certainly more serious than sexual assaults. When you have a mayhem situation, an acid blinding, for example, of a victim, it would also include armed robberies. Sexual assault in the first degree would include that. It includes your most serious violent crimes. And what the committee should realize is that when we're talking about repeat offenders, in other words, a person commits a sexual assault in the first degree, and he has a prior felony conviction, any felony conviction within a 7-year period, that person faces a presumptive sentence of 10 years imprisonment under the current law. And under the current law, the judge would have the authority to increase that sentence up to 20 years if it was an aggravated assault, and he would have also have the authority to decrease it down to 5, but the judge himself could not go lower than 5 years imprisonment. We generally feel that that is an adequate provision, but when we're talking about first offenders, a person that goes out and commits his first sexual assault or any A felony, there is no presumptive sentence unless the offender was armed with a firearm or caused serious physical injury. And in that case, it's 6 years. And when the criminal code was being considered, the administration was pushing for presumptive sentencing for all offenders, and as a political compromise, essentially, presumptive sentencing was adopted, but it only applied for repeat offenders. We have a separate bill, House Bill 293, that would make presumptive sentencing applicable to all first offenders. But for purposes of this bill before us today, we've drafted a proposed committee substitute that would take Class A felon offenses only, Class A felon offenses only, and specify a presumptive sentence of 8 years if the offense was committed while the defendant possessed the firearm, used the deadly weapon, or caused serious physical injury. That would be an increase of the presumptive sentence that we have today for that type of conduct from 6 years to 8 years. Additionally, in situations where the offender did not use a deadly weapon or a firearm or caused serious physical injury, the bill that we have proposed as a committee substitute for this would specify a presumptive sentence of 5 years imprisonment. And again, this would not change the classification of sexual assault in the first degree. It would simply say that for an A felony, and again, we're talking about sexual assault in the first degree and all the serious violent crime, it would specify the presumptive sentence across the board of 5 and 8 years, depending on the circumstances. Now, the reason we feel that the approach we have suggested is preferable to the one set forth in this bill is that it's keyed to the overall structure of the criminal code. Instead of, this is my own personal opinion, but I feel that one of the problems with our old criminal law was that when an issue that was very topical hit the front pages, the legislature would have a chance to look solely at that provision by itself and not consider how it related to other offenses. And I feel that even though we agree that the penalty should be revised for this offense, taking this approach, making it an unclassified felony, I think is kind of, in a sense, bastardizing the criminal code, because I think the legislature and the commission gave substantial thought to whether sexual assault in the first degree should be an unclassified felony or an A felony, and it concluded it should be an A felony, and it concluded that it's really comparable to other offenses. Where the commission went wrong was in not establishing presumptive sentencing for first offense A felonies as well as other first offenses. So this retains the structure of the criminal code as saying this is an A felony, and without having elaborate sentencing provisions, makes one really minor change and specifies the presumptive sentence for the A felon offense. Additionally, it's possible that under the proposal, a person who has a prior record, I'm talking about under the bill that is before you, a person that has a prior record is going to be treated less severely than under current law. And let me give you one example. Under the under current law, if a person commits a sexual assault in the first degree and has two prior felony convictions, regardless of whether those were for sexual assault in the first degree, they could be for felony theft, they could be for burglary, they could be for robbery. If that person has two prior felony convictions, that person faces a presumptive sentence of 15 years under the existing statutes. Under this bill,
Mr. Stern, are you dealing with the work draft now that we have? Have you had an opportunity to get a copy of that?
No, it has not been provided to me. It has not been provided to me. If you or staff tell me what that does to the point that I'm addressing, I'm sure
we have extra copies in the robbing room. The only changes there are the technical change on the section change on page one, and the other change is the one I talked about on the telephone the other day is about committee enhancement on page five, stating prior conviction territory, state of Alaska, elsewhere on Pennsylvania. Presently charged in the state with the sexual assault in the first degree. There's no substantive change to that 20-year rule that you're talking about in subsection 5 of section 13, which is, I think, it's on line 20 of page 5. So you're still talking about what is substantively in the committee substance.
Oh, so my point is still applicable?
That's right.
Okay. So Under the current statute, if a person has two prior felony convictions and commits a sexual assault in the first degree, he faces a presumptive sentence of 15 years. Under this bill, he would face a mandatory minimum of 5 years. We could quibble over whether that's going to be imposed or not, but I'm just pointing that out for the committee's consideration. The thing about the approach that you've taken in terms of prior convictions is that you key it into a prior conviction for sexual assault, whereas the criminal code says it's any felony. So, if I might, I have made copies of the draft proposal that we have drafted. And again, let me point out that there's no disagreement between the Department of Law or the sponsors of this bill that something needs to be done in terms of strengthening the penalty structure for the crime of sexual assault in the first degree. We've taken a different approach to it, and we feel that considering the legislature's decision in 1980 to classify as an A felony, considering the availability of the option of going with presumptive sentencing for Class A felonies, that the approach we've suggested is preferable. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do committee members have questions? There being none, I have one. Let me see which bill. House Bill 576. Do you plan to also offer a language change for that bill that you wish us to consider?
On the videotaping?
Yes.
I have not drafted that, but I can get together with your staff.
I'd be pleased to.
Yes.
There being no questions, thank you, Mr. Excuse me, Mr. Cook.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a few questions on 473 and on 576. I'll start with 473.
Yes.
On that question of changing or deleting subsection 5 of 13 on page 5, that's the 20-year enhancement.
Yes.
There was testimony from the district attorney for the second judicial district that, as far as he was concerned, this would be favorable if it stated that if you committed an unclassified felony and have previously committed an unclassified felony, and of course these don't have those 7-year forgiveness periods that the presumptives do, by the way, which would be a big difference in this adding up that you came to a minute ago, but if you had a previous unclassified felony and then you committed another one, that whatever the period was, say 20 years, he felt that at that time in that testimony that would be more appropriate. In other words, instead of limiting it to rape or first degree sexual assault, make it across the board. Do you have any first question I have on this? Do you have any opinions about that?
Well, if I recall correctly, the subcommission and the legislature back in 1978, when they considered the unclassified crimes, felt that there wasn't a need to have specific provisions in there for repeat unclassified crimes. In other words, this, first of all, the situation where a person commits a murder and then goes out and commits another murder are very rare. And secondly, the provisions in the criminal code that would specify, that would already include a mandatory minimum sentence and allow the judge the authority to go as high as 99 years, we just felt it was just adding unnecessary sections to the criminal code. I guess in terms of being concerned that the judge would not impose an appropriate sentence, the committee felt that that was not a valid consideration when you're talking about repeat unclassified felonies. Now, to the extent that you go ahead and adopt sexual assault in the first degree as an unclassified felony, there may be some justification for that because people do commit sexual assault in the first degree and then go out and perhaps kill. You know, that's more typical than having two murders committed by the same person.
And would they, well, aren't you now talking about sections 1 through 4? I was really zeroing in on the 20-year enhancement thing. It's pretty common for a rapist, as might use that term, to commit another rape later on. And as this stands now, it would apply only to that. I was just saying that the district attorney said instead of seeing rape or this sort of first-degree sexual assault is actually penetration and forcible penetration resulting in serious bodily injury. That's the only kind that's covered there. Assuming this was an became an unclassified felony under this or some of the bill, then as far as the 20-year enhancement, he was saying that instead of just limiting to that, let's take first-degree, second-degree murder, kidnapping, and this penetration and attempted penetration resulting in injury, and say that if anybody has committed any one of those before at any time, because, like I say, that's the one fault I find in your analysis of adding up to 15 years, that you've got the 7-year forgiveness period there. Now, as an aside, I wondered if you had any thoughts about whether that should be changed to 7 years. But anyway, there's no such forgiveness period here. And he was saying, let's put that on all unclassified felonies. If you have any particular opinions.
Well, structurally, I would probably even go further than him theoretically and say it's any felony. But the problem is that we're creating another, we have presumptive sentencing on one hand about increased penalty structure, and then what this bill is setting up, the way I would see it, is having a separate penalty structure applicable for unclassified felonies. And if you look at what the criminal code did for increasing sentences for presumptive sentences, it was any felony. So similarly, you would say, well, it should be any felony for these unclassified offenses. So I would certainly agree with, if you're going to go with this kind of structure, I would agree with what the DA said.
But
I think the structure is not appropriate.
It would, there's no doubt, it would basically take away from the not the perhaps the substantive integrity, but the structure of the criminal code as it was formed by that committee over the years.
Oh, sure. No question. And the only, in the years that the code has been in effect, frankly, we have not been aware of, we've only been aware of one case, and that was in Anchorage where a sentence for a sexual assault was seen particularly inappropriate, and I believe it was a suspended imposition of sentence that was imposed in Anchorage for first-degree sexual assault. Now, under both your bill and the bill we proposed, that would be impossible. Under your bill, it'd have to be a mandatory minimum of 5 years. We would have a presumptive sentence of 5 years.
Tell me about the decision that came out this year or last year.
Well, I don't think it was a Supreme Court decision. I thought it was a Superior Court.
That was all I wanted to respond to.
Thank you. Before you go on, Mr. Stern, I know that you're very aware that people around the state of Alaska, and particularly so in the more metropolitan areas, are extremely concerned about the increase in the rape rate and the like of prosecution, or not particularly prosecution, but the life sentences that they had been given and been allowed to get back on the street and rest again. That's the intent of this bill, just to get them off the street. Would you care to comment on that?
We feel, and it's obviously in our proposal, that if you commit any Class A felony offense, including rape, you should be going to jail. And we both agree on there. It's just a matter of how to go about doing it. Under the current law, the judge has the discretion to go to zero for a first offense. Under your bill, he couldn't go any less than five. Under our bill, he's got a presumptive sentence of five to face. So we have the same approach. It's just a matter of how we accomplish it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cook, you may continue.
Thank you. I think I'll leave that and go back to 576, the videotaping.
Yes.
Yes. Follow what you were saying about the fact that the bill has two alternatives, a videotaping and a closed courtroom. I believe you were saying, in fact, and Mr. Crum had said it to you, that it was good to have the alternatives, because in some places, what it all boiled down to is prosecutor is not going to try the case unless that victim's in the courtroom, because he's not going to be able to get the jury to return a guilty beyond reasonable doubt verdict, right? But in some instances, he might feel he could still do that and save the victim from the grief and suffering, so forth.
Yes.
Correct. All right. I was looking at the Florida. I know you've got copies of these other state acts, I believe. And in fact, I think you've got some of them that we don't have yet. But the Florida Act, 1977, covers closing the courtroom. The Florida Video Act, video deposition is 1979, 2 years later. But the Florida closed courtroom statute applies to persons under the age of 16, so in other words, 15-year-olds and older. And it says the court shall clear the courtroom. It's mandatory. The video deposition session puts the age at 11 years of age or younger, and says that the court may grant an order if he finds that the age, 11 years or younger, that there is a substantial likelihood that this child will suffer severe emotional or mental strain if required to testify, which I think is fairly close to the language in 576. And then he provides that the deposition and so on. But it also has, I don't know why this is in there, but a provision that the application will be made prior to the trial, but the videotaping will only be made after the trial has started. I only bring all this out so there's nothing taken out of context about this act, but the main thing that presses me about this, they said, all right, the court, it doesn't even say anything about a motion. The court will be closed, and I understand that's the same in Massachusetts, and that's led to this whole newspaper case that's hopefully going to come down from the Supreme Court pretty soon, but it's mandatory closing, and then it's discretionary on this part. Now, our bill, our 576, whether it's discretionary, and certain things have to be considered. Do you have any thoughts about that? I want to ask that first.
Yes, I do. I think it should stay discretionary. I think there may be times where the victim is capable of testifying before a jury, before an open courtroom. I think the public has a fundamental interest, I think, in understanding what exactly is happening in terms of these offenses. If we're going to be closing the courtroom every time a sexual assault on a victim occurs as a matter of routine, as a matter of statute, I think that the whole subject is going to be hushed up. That's what I'm concerned about, and the public discussion, or the public, as Representative Barnes says, the public is really concerned about this, and the reason they're concerned about it is because they know of these trials, they know of these events, and I think that we don't want to be going into adopting a statute that made automatic closing of a courtroom for any type of offense. It may very well be in 50% of the cases we're going to move for a closing of the courtroom. I doubt it if it's even going to be that high. But I think we would be opposed to that for the reasons that the public has an interest in these cases, and it should be before the public when it doesn't do violence to the rights of the victim.
I was only bringing that up because that would establish a difference between the two sections, and I know that, and I think you may have a valid concern, that if you don't put any difference there on this presumption language, then that might be somehow prone to attack, and they'll say this videotaping done, and the defense attorney comes in later and says, all right, fine, they've got the same language in there, he could have closed the courtroom, and that would not have violated my client's right to confront in open courtroom and so forth and so on. So I think that's along the line, but that would not be the sort of change that would get to that.
I'm sure, Bill, that having an identical presumption in the bill was a drafting error, whoever did it. I really do believe it was an error. And if we researched it, we'd probably find there was a different presumption for one and the other.
Well, I read the other. You do feel that there needs to be, if it's going to be discretionary, there has to be a presumption, though.
Well, it certainly is going to help us. But on the other extent, as you recognize and was brought out before the committee, that the extent that we have the presumption, the constitutionality of it is more subject to attack. But we feel the presumption is an appropriate one.
One other thing on this, I may have misunderstood what you were saying right at the very beginning on this bill, but this bill does say 16 years of age or younger. In one place it says under 16, that's a technical error on line 23 on one. It should be changed, but it does say that age at the time of sexual assault. I thought you said that you would prefer that having that age at the time of the trial, but maybe I didn't hear that.
I may have misspoke because, frankly, I've got the situation here where I've got all the bills here on sexual assault, and I may have been looking at the, there's like four bills on videotaping, and your bill, of course, has at the time of the sexual assault. It should be at the testimony. At the time of the testimony.
You want it at the time of the testimony?
Yes. In other words, you have the assault on the person that's 15, and by the time the trial gets around, for whatever reason, whether it's an appeal or whether it's just simply delayed, the person's 18. In terms of the constitutionality of it, I wonder about it.
Mr. Cook, do you have any questions?
Mm-hmm.
The members of the committee have questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Stern, and we are appreciative of the language and we will be studying.
Thank you.
We'll go back to Karen Robinson.
Yeah, Madam Chairman and committee, I'm Karen Robinson, and I've been working in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault for 5 years now as the executive director of AWARE, which is the Women's Crisis Center. And I'm also here to speak on behalf of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault as the president of the network. For the ones of you who may not know, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is a nonprofit corporation which is comprised now of 17 programs across the state. Most of our money, which is received through grants through the new established Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The bills I'd like to speak on is House Bill 473 and House Bill 576. And I think I'll start with House Bill 576. This bill, the network has been involved with and has been working with since the first original bill was introduced back when Senator Parr was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We are definitely in favor of this bill. We feel it's tremendously important that the trauma that the young victims go through, that if by chance we can help establish a system that can help them through the court system, that is definitely preferable. The one area that we would like to possibly see added to this bill is we're finding out within the rural areas that there is a lot of these cases are taking quite a while to get through the court system. And we would like it to be consider the possibility of having court priorities on child sexual assault cases. At this point, we have not seen that within the Juneau area and or, as I understand, the Anchorage area, but within the rural areas, this seems to be quite a problem. And we definitely know as studies now that rape trauma syndrome is quite a tremendous problem for child sexual assault victims also, and each time they have to repeat the story and bring the story back up, it prolongs the trauma that they go through. And if we can begin to get these cases through a lot quicker and help them get through it so they can move on, then we may really help assist them in the problem of rape trauma syndrome.
I have a question for Bill. Bill, here. Is there any way we can, okay, Karen mentioned something about adding a section or whatever, to tell the court to speed up on these things? Or is,
well,
is
the
that
only
a
thing
more
I've seen in internal, that was basically, I think you're talking about priority for these types of cases.
Yeah.
Right, and it could be for all, you know, all sexual assault cases and
well,
not just child victims.
Mechanically, if you did it, it'd be by altering the rules of court, I think, as well as the legislation. I'm not sure about what that might be. I think that had to be researched to see if that was infringing on the other branch of government. I did see capital punishment bill somewhere that said that those kind of cases would have priority when they got to the Supreme Court, but that's a whole different, that's almost apples and oranges, because you're talking about a different purpose than talking about at trial. And that would be the main concern I would have, would be that it would be getting involved in separation of powers, but that can be checked out.
I'm not so sure that we would have any kind of a problem changing the rules of court. I think all it takes is 2/3 vote. But I'm not sure if we don't have the problem in the urban areas of the state, and we just have that problem with, you know, scheduling of the cases. And putting them in a priority on a priority basis, that we need, or that this would be a legislative kind of a situation that we want to take care of legislatively. It just seems to me, and I'll ask you, have you contacted the court system and attempted to get them to, you know, consider those cases a little bit more important, or have you dealt with them at all in that regard?
I personally have not. Jackie Ruman, who's been the director of the Bethel program, might have.
We've spoken of it.
To the court.
Yeah, and we've tried to deal with it in our area, but our area works together a great deal. And so I think that someone has to be really a real advocate for the victim, and we have an awful lot of outlying areas where you don't have programs that are as strong as the kind of useful.
But who?
Representative Phillips, you have the floor.
I just want to follow up on Chuck's question. Who have you talked to? I mean, if you just talked to just people in the court, or you talked to the director of the court system, or judges, or
judges.
Well, then but I don't think they actually have control of the flow of cases. I mean, it's court administration, right? Right.
Well, I'm not sure what the situation would be out in Bethel, but it just seems to me that there's a strong likelihood, I suppose, that the court system out there is overloaded, just like it is in many other parts of the state. And if that's the case in Bethel, maybe they are getting absolutely the quickest treatment they can possibly get out there with under the conditions that prevail. I don't know that, you know, to be a fact, but that's a possibility. But I'm certain that the courts would certainly listen to any suggestions or any recommendations that you'd want to make, and go to them with the, and I'm not talking about going to a judge, but go to the administrator of the court system and attempt to deal with them on that level. I'm not sure, from what we've heard just now from the witness, that there's a legislative remedy that would be appropriate.
Point is well taken, and we will do more research on that, and I will talk to more of the rural programs and find out exactly how much they have talked with their court systems and whether or not they're amenable to those changes, and maybe look in another direction of how we can put some pressure in, maybe in another way. If there's not any other questions, I'll move on to the next bill.
Are there other questions on this bill?
Aye, aye.
Excuse me.
I did one. just want an emphasis on this. Karen, you're talking about the trauma syndrome, that you would prefer that the case be processed right off, and you agree then with Mr. Stern that they should be within the, not beyond the legal age, like they have to be, you know, if they are 10, 11, 12, they should not, the patient go beyond the age of 18.
You know, basically, truth, I mean, if you want my truthful opinion, and I would like to see a bill that passed where no rape victim would probably ever have to testify again in front of an open court. But I also know that's not, you know, reasonable, and that at this point, that we feel it's probably best to leave it at that age, and that, yes, once a person has reached the legal age, then they can move and testify in front of the court.
Are there other questions? You may go to the next bill.
Okay, the next bill is House Bill 473, and at this time, the statewide network has not come up with a solid position. We are still doing research. We have contacted and will be contacting more people within the lower 48 who have worked on work in sexual assault cases. I just want to bring four concerns to you that we have. And I'm now doing research, hoping that I can document some of those concerns so that, and some of these are just concerns that may need other pieces of legislation and just to be looked at. Of course, one of our concerns is that we feel that judges may be unwilling to support the bill because it designates sentencing requirements, thereby removing their power from the bench. And we feel that's something obviously y'all have heard and definitely needs to be looked at. Our second concern is that the correctional system does not offer a rehabilitation program, and nor does incarceration prove to be a deterrent to the crime. And that we do at this point have one sex offender treatment program set out at Lemon Creek, and you know, we feel that no matter how many years that you put these men in jail, that until there is programs set up, and I'm talking about sex offender treatment programs and not just your basic jail programs, because we know that those programs do not work for these men, and that maybe at another time I would, you know, love to do and talk with you about programs that are set up in the lower 48 and how they're working, and you know, give a lot more information on that. But we feel that it's something that desperately needs to be looked at. And until it looked at, if that's looked at, that no matter how long these people stay in jail, that we do know that they're going to get out and they're going to offend again. And so they're going to continue to have victims. Basically what we want is no more victims. Our third issue is there is a concern that because the sentencing for sexual assault are more severe, that the perpetrators may murder their victims in order to eliminate the only witness to the crime. And there are articles out at this point, and again, I've stated I will definitely get these articles to you. That's a real fear of ours, that we have definitely seen that when you stiffen the penalty, and that basically it's just as easy to do away with your witness. That if you're going to go to jail for a long period of time, you might as well try to take your chances and not have your witness around. And we're just hoping again that the committee has really looked at this seriously, and again, I'm sorry I don't have the information at this point to give you, and I will be getting that to you, and just again for it to be considered and to be looked at. Our last concern is that the conviction rate in sexual assault cases have indicated the public is basically uneducated and regarding to the issues of sexual assault, and that we've seen in the past, and obviously with a lot of education from our programs, both in testifying as expert witnesses and doing our own way of educating the juries when we're testifying, that we have another fear that we've seen in the past, that they are very reluctant to put these people behind jail if they feel that they're, you know, for a long period of time. And we know that when within these cases, the evidence are really hard to obtain in the first place, and that a lot of times it's her word against his word, and that we have found that if the penalty is a lot stiffer, that people are just a lot less likely to convict these people. and that at this point we've been seeing for the first time a lot more convictions than we've ever seen in the past. And again, I know this is to the fact that we've been educating and we've been doing as much education as we can. And the last thing I'd just like to state that on behalf of the network that, you know, we find it extremely exciting that, you know, that both the committee here and the legislature has really begun to look at the seriousness of both domestic violence and sexual assault, and that beginning to address the issues at this point. We thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Do members of the committee have questions? Mr. Cook, do you have questions?
Yes, ma'am, just one. On the last major concern you had of the public being not educated and then the public gets on the jury, I think what, and we've talked about this yesterday, I part of this is we feel that the juries are only aware of the of some higher penalties, and therefore they don't want to, even though they're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did this particular crime, they'll give what we call a jury nullification and just look the other way because they don't want to get the higher penalty.
Well,
getting that about right?
Slightly. You know, I just I think we've seen that, you know, in the past that people were very reluctant to put someone in jail for that long a period of time. And that
well, I just, if I might, just I wanted to ask you if you perceive any contradiction between that position and the position of the rapists themselves. Let's assume the first rapist who's not, I'm not being facetious, but somebody hasn't been to law school or read the papers a lot about what the legislature is doing. This is the same public as the jurors. It just happened that they commit rape. Isn't there some contradiction in terms of the public is not well informed, so the jury wouldn't be well informed, but on the other hand, the rapist would be in deciding whether to become a murderer too to eradicate the rest.
Okay, well, both of them, you're looking at the more severeness of the crime. I mean, the jury at that point would not want to convict, yes, because it's, you know, the penalties are so severe. And then on the other hand, yes, the rapist may be more likely to kill his victim if he knows he's going to get a penalty of that severity.
But then you're talking about a murder that the juror has I just felt that there's some contradiction in saying the jurors are not well informed, but the rapists are, but maybe I didn't.
Right. I think a lot of people need a lot more information, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. We appreciate the testimony. Jackie Rumo? Oh, excuse me, that was
Randy. I just want to make an observation here. The public seems to be very concerned about this, yet the public is also the jury.
I'm sorry, Andy.
The public's very concerned about it. They have been, and I know for the last 2 years. Yet, the public is also members of the jury. And somehow that doesn't.
Well,
you know,
I think you have to see that basically, you know, every jury, if the juror is not exactly the people who've been educated who are really that concerned. People are concerned on one hand, but I think they still. Once they, you know, get into the situation of being sitting on the jury and looking at the fact that the evidence in a lot of these cases are just so tough, and they're looking at the fact they're fixing to put this person behind bars for a long period of time, and I just think they really think hard about that.
Well, I, you know, I agree with you, but I just also see there's a little conflict or contradiction.
Right.
Same public saying, well, we got to have different families, yet we don't see it. Or
yeah. Well, I think part of the public is saying if you want to have different penalties is coming a lot from the voices. I mean, I don't think it's coming from a lot of people who may be on the jury. I mean, I think it's just beginning to start taking place and stuff. I mean, I know what you're saying, but I still think you're still two separate people. I mean, you know, yeah, one hand we're hearing some real loud voices, on the other hand we still have, I'd say, at least two-thirds of our population uneducated. And, you know, that's all I'd say.
If I might comment on that, Representative Phillips, over the last 3 years, it's been my impression that there has been a tremendous public concern and outcry. I have in my file
from one petition, over 1,000 people signed it, asking for just exactly this sort of law and supporting this bill. And I have other petitions and, of course, letters from all over the state supporting this type of legislation.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it's sort of, you know, here you get, you know, I hear it in my district from people, and yet these are the very same people, or I shouldn't say very same, but similar people that would serve on a jury. From housewives and carpenters.
My impression is, Randy, that in the last few years, if any of these cases have gotten before the juries, that if they have the opportunity of sentencing, and they don't, you know, the judge is doing the sentencing, and what is happening, the juries are convicting. The judge is sentencing and allowing them to get back out on the street and walk around and race again.
Yeah.
That's my observation of what is happening. From all that I've read, I understand, and from the mail that I've received across the state. Mr. Cook, you had a comment?
Yes, ma'am. Just one short one. I was just going to say that if there's a serious question about the Jekyll and Hyde thing with the public becoming jurors, it might be very instructive to get actual testimony of people who've been on rape juries instead of just us outsiders looking in and try to think what they did. We can only generalize these things. I don't fault the generalization, but if it was requested, I would make an effort to try to, that can be done, and take a little bit of trouble back to make an effort to try to secure 10 or 15 jurors in different places on different rape juries.
Mr. Cook, I know that you do know that we've taken these bills all around the state during the interim, and the places that we have not been, we've had teleconference hookups. There has been a tremendous amount of support for this bill. So I don't believe that we have time, you know, to go into extensive work now as far as other public testimony. I wish that we had that time available to us for other public testimony, but we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Because we have given the public around the state an opportunity to testify on all these bills. And I feel confident that we have gotten good public input. Yes, Representative Buckholz.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's a need to pass legislation like this and right away, but I can understand where Karen is coming from. I think that there is a public misinformation or lack of interest or whatever. Perhaps it can be addressed in a separate field where we can have more information on this, or fund the different programs available and let them do a little bit more PR to emphasize the severity of this crime and let it go at that. But perhaps the best way is to do pass legislation like this and the PR address it elsewhere.
Well, I agree with you, Representative Buckholz. I do believe that these things need to be done, and I believe that separate legislation needs to be used to address it. Karen, excuse me, Ms. Robinson, if you wish to continue testifying,
okay.
I'll have to have you come back to the table.
Okay, I just wanted to say, you know, just not testify anymore, but just say one other thing. When it comes, I guess, you know, in my 5 years, I probably have been the direct advocate working with probably close to, you know, I'd say 20 rape victims, and I think when you're talking about the jury, there's never been what I would call a clean-cut rape case.
Yeah.
And the ones that are clean-cut, where the man comes in the house, rapes her in her bed, we don't catch those people. I mean, I've never, you know, we've had 6 of them here last year. We didn't catch any of them. And so I think that's part of what it is, too, is when it gets to the juries listening to it, is the fact that, I mean, it's very hard to, I mean, I can see where they're at. I mean, obviously, I believe the victim, well, they've got some evidence they have to see, and there's never been a clean one. I mean, there's always something that, unfortunately, is just not quite there. And cases that I felt that they were clean and should have gone right through, it was amazing they didn't. So, thank you.
You're quite welcome. Do other members of the committee have questions or comments? Robin, would you please check and see if there are others signed up on the sign-up sheet to testify on any of this bill?
Okay, well, this is the observer sign-up sheet right here. That's the one signed up on.
Does anyone else wish to testify on these bills? We'll get the information from Mr. Stern and the language that he's offering on these bills, and we will get back together and start our mock-up and our work on them at sometime next week. Since we were informed today that there will be another joint meeting on Friday, we will not be having a meeting tomorrow or Friday because of those two joint meetings. When we start in session at 1:30 and we start here at 1:15, we simply have 15 minutes. So we will not meet again until Monday. At that time, we will take up House Bill 180. Rhonda Butterfield will be here from the Department of Law. After we have had testimony on that bill and our markup, we're going to start markup on all these bills to get them out. And then we have other crime bills in the committee that we will be announcing hearings on beginning at the end of next week. With that,
are we going to have something written out as far as what days we're taking the bills up? Friday and so on and so forth.
Yes, if you would like, I will.
Yeah, I would. I mean, yeah. Have it posted on.
Well, we did post all of it, but it's on the board upstairs.
Oh, okay.
It's been posted there all week.
Okay, but we're going to have a weekly.
It comes out every Thursday.
Okay.
So tomorrow we will literally post again the hearings for next week, but we will be continuing these bills. For the first part of the week on Friday, it is my intent, and I will announce it now so that he can start doing his work. It is my intent next Friday to take up the two bills that were introduced this week or next week. I'm sorry, I don't have as much.
What bill are they? 32 and 33?
Yeah. They're real processing.
There being no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned.
The subcommittee.